Hello, everyone. There is something I'm trying to do with this as well, which is a little different. You'll notice at the bottom there is both my Twitter handle and a hashtag, COHDMV. For people that are watching online or people that might be anxious about actually asking a question, feel free to tweet me with that hashtag, and your question may follow up this talk. Now, a little bit about this talk. First off, this is going to be focusing on the U.S. and Canada context because of how these documents that we're going to be focusing on are treated in these countries. In most other countries, there's something of a national identity card. Driver's licenses are not frequently accepted as a form of valid identification. All the information that you're seeing here is presented from open sources. I mention this because I did spend 7 years working for a state driver services agency, including a couple years in their law enforcement agency. I worked as a civilian. My main job was keeping them honest. However, just want to make that clear. And again, like I said, tweet me questions. You might get answers. Of course, the first thing is everyone here that has experience in North America has gone to a DMV. We call it DMV, MVA, driver services, what have you. Pretty much in North American society, you need a credential from one of these agencies, be it an actual driving license or a non-driver identification card. So the first part of the process of identity management, if you will, is the actual front of the house where you start the process of getting the card. Issuance today is a lot different than it used to be. In some places around the world, they still will issue on the spot. Pretty much every jurisdiction in North America now issues via what's called central issuance, meaning they mail you a credential. For some people, that might seem like, okay, that's been the case forever, but in some jurisdictions, that is still relatively new. Currently, ID cards are highly influenced in the U.S. by the Real ID Act. Now, there's a lot of misconceptions about what the Real ID Act is. The short version, at least from my point of view, is it's a good idea, except that it's implemented 180 degrees wrong. AMVA is the entity that defines the standards for these documents in the U.S. and Canada. AMVA is the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators. Essentially, it's the industry group for DMVs. They define technical standards for things like license plates, driver's licenses, title documents. And they do, of course, lobby like every industry group does. The standard that is used for driver's licenses is inspired by, but not entirely ISO compliant. There is an ISO standard for licenses. Anybody that is from Europe will know, for example, that they are pink. That is the actual ISO color for driving licenses. And finally, at least in North America, there's only three companies that actually issue these documents. I hate that this mic is popping on me. Now, the front of the house staff, that's the people that I'm referring to, front of the house, back of the house, which feels a little more convenient for me, but we're talking about the people that you interact with as a member of the public versus the people that are in back offices doing other work. Their job is to serve as a first line of fraud detection. When we talk about fraud, of course, we're talking about, in this context, we're talking about imposters and counterfeit source documents. You're not likely to find a lot of people coming in with counterfeit driver's licenses or ID cards if you're working there, because generally speaking, the people that work there, they know what they should look like. Applications require verification of documents presented. We'll go into that in a moment. And the newest trend, which is a Real ID related development, is that that the agencies will save scanned copies of what is presented. Where do they keep them? They keep them in databases that are internal to that agency. More about that in a moment. In the US, one of the main verifications that you'll find is called Social Security Online Verification, or SSOLV. When you go to the DMV, pretty much every jurisdiction I've seen requires either the actual Social Security card or a W-2 or 1099 form with that number on there. In some places, they'll let you just say it. In reality, they could just let you say it anywhere because this is considered the authoritative way of verifying it. This is an AMVA database. I'm sorry, it's an AMVA system that hooks into Social Security's systems. When the clerk enters that information onto their system, they're entering the actual Social Security number, legal name, date of birth, and gender. Gender right now is not used as a marker for verification, though considering the inclinations of this administration in DC, that could change. When it works right, it just says go ahead, gives it an error code of zero. Other error codes that come up include things like there's a no match on the name. This happens more frequently than you'd think, and not for malicious reasons. Primarily, we've got a lot of folks out there that do change their names legally. If they don't tell Social Security about that name change, Social Security doesn't know, this throws an error, things happen. Date of birth may not match. Some people have their dates of birth inverted. So for instance, if you were born on 5/6/13, which one is it? Or is it May 6th, or is it the 6th, or is it the 5th of June? Sometimes there are such errors that happen even in this country. And finally, is the SSN in the death file? 75 million Social Security numbers are there. Some people might want to impersonate someone who's passed on. That's where these systems come into play. Additional verifications come into play for individuals that are non-citizens. The SAVE system is a DHS program. It's been up for, I believe, a decade now. It is used every agency will use it for non-citizens that have status. I'm using very specific language, I know. So I'm talking about people that are in a status but are not residents. Things like H-1 workers or students or their dependents, O-2 are the dependents of outstanding individuals in the U.S., A-2 are certain diplomatic staff. Yes, these agencies do occasionally issue credentials to people that have some kind of a diplomatic visa. That is not common. Usually, ironically enough, the Department of State has its own DMV, that is what they call it, to cover licenses for diplomats and consuls. Canadian DMVs do a similar process for non-citizens and for citizens that are born outside of the country. They verify the root documents presented with the Citizenship and Immigration Canada. Other things that need to be checked out are you decent behind the wheel, for lack of a better way of putting it? PDPS, Problem Driver Pointer System, it lets agencies know if you've got some outstanding problem in another jurisdiction. Some outstanding problem is a very vague term, and that is deliberately so. That could be anything from you have a tendency to drink before you drive and have 20 DUIs, or it could be that you forgot to pay a stop sign ticket in Bumblebrook. I don't know which one it is. If I'm behind the counter, I won't know which one it is unless you resolve it. The idea being that if you're not able to drive in one jurisdiction, then you will not be allowed to drive in another. Of course, these source specific are concerning driver's licenses. ID cards obviously don't have these checks. The CDLIS, Commercial Driver License Information System, is a little more in-depth for individuals that drive commercial vehicles. Commercial drivers have a lot of rules on them. It is very easy for a bad driver to slip afoul of those rules. They could be under suspensions. There are certain offenses for which they can lose their ability to drive a CDL for life, as an example. And I think everyone here would agree this is probably a good one. If you are intoxicated and driving a vehicle full of hazardous cargo, you are banned from driving a CDL for life. IRE is the Canadian version, Interprovincial Records Exchange. Again, that primarily is to trade records between Canadian provinces, but it does hook into the US system. The US system also hooks into the Canadian system. Now, in the future, there are two things that are being worked on. The first one is called state to state. This is to make sure that individuals don't have more than one driver's license or ID in the country. Ideally, they want to expand it so it includes Canada. The idea is to have authority control over the driver record. They want to make sure that what happens with state to state is, if you apply, you have a driver's license from somewhere else, even if you don't present it, the person behind the counter will be aware of that existence and then basically give you the agony of choice between getting the new license or keeping the old one. Finally, electronic verification of vital events is primarily concerned with birth certificates issued in the US. Now, this is admittedly a pilot that failed, but they are still investigating this because they want to be able to verify all the root documents that are presented. Something I didn't mention here, what I mean by a root document. These are the papers that you show that provide you with proof of identity by just being, in a way. So think of your birth certificate. Does it have a photo of you? Does it have fingerprints, footprints, DNA on there? No. You present a birth certificate that says your name is Chuck Jones, generally speaking, they're going to think that you are Chuck Jones. Obviously, this is a weak point. Same with Social Security cards in the United States. You present Chuck Jones's Social Security card in a situation like this, there is a tendency to think that you are Chuck Jones. So, still learning how to use this properly, so I apologize for the hiccups in the talk. Now, as I mentioned, with issuance, that's the process of actually turning that little piece of plastic into something that'll let you buy a beer. Just about every jurisdiction uses central issuance. To my knowledge, the last one that didn't was Delaware, because they have exactly one office that issues driver's licenses, which means that, functionally speaking, it's the same thing. What that means also is that it's sent by mail in an unmarked envelope from a secure facility, as they'll say. However, these secure facilities are run by three companies in North America. The first one is IDEMIA. This company has changed names twice since I've started following this. They used to be known as MorphoTrust. Safran, I believe, is their parent company. It's a mess. I know people are going to think, Canadian bank, wait a minute, money company? Well, yeah, they do more than just currency. They also produce identity documents. Canadian driver's licenses, personal opinion, are slightly higher quality documents than you typically find from most U.S. States. And Gemalto. Gemalto, again, for those of you who aren't aware of who Gemalto is, they're a major multinational. They are involved in credit cards, smart cards, identity documents, you name it. And finally, about the future of issuance. Now, this is actually an existing product as of, I think, about 3 weeks ago. It's called LA Wallet. This is Louisiana. This is to put your driver's license on your phone. This is something that a lot of states are looking into because people don't like carrying wallets around. This connects real time to the OMV's servers, as they call it in Louisiana. So you would produce this, it would say when they last verified that it was valid. And this is a mobile driver's license. Now, some of you might think, why am I saying mobile instead of digital? Not just because it's a phone, but because the term digital driver's license, at least within the industry, refers to the current types of plastic cars we get, because those are digitally produced. Yes, I know. I didn't name it. I'm just letting you know what it is. Now, finally, about securing the credential. Back in the day, I mean, I'm sure that some of you remember getting a card that was a laminated piece of Polaroid film. I know that was my first driver's license and ID card. Nowadays, let's start with the camera that you're staring down when you get the image. What you don't see in that pillar is a 15 to 20 megapixel prosumer camera. They want to get a good image. Not just because, well, they want to make sure everyone knows how ugly you are when you get the card. We're going to go into that part of it in a moment. The substrates, the actual card material, is distribution controlled, similar to how banknote paper is. Most cards that you find in the US are based on PET or PFC, usually a combination of both of these materials. That's why it has that sort of feel to it. Now, newer cards, like you'll find in New York, most Canadian provinces, Virginia, Washington, D.C., those are polycarbonate-based, similar to some passports have polycarbonate info sheets. The idea being that these are nearly impossible, as far as I've been able to research, to counterfeit. You just do not find a good fake Virginia license anywhere. There are multiple layers of security. I'm going to gloss over the details of this because I'm going to talk a little more in the next slide. Whenever you look at these documents, there's three levels of security. There's overt security, things that you can see with a naked eye. So as an example of an overt security feature that you'll see in the New York driver's license, which has the clear window that you can see the same image through, that's an overt security feature. Covert features are things that are not immediately visible. Whenever you see that bouncer flash that UV light onto your document, that UV is considered a covert feature. Other covert features include things like microtext, deliberate errors, certain features of holograms. And finally are forensic features, trying to find out information on forensic features, working through an open source context, that's hard, to put it mildly. Forensic features are used often by programs that automatically determine if the credential is valid. Sometimes it's considered forensic information to read the barcode on the back of a driver's license, particularly since most of them have an encrypted portion. Now, with regards to these features, there's an excellent guide that you can get, called the ICE Guide to Document Security Features. Because this was designed for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, this does have a focus on passports. However, the same features you'll find in passports, you'll find a lot of them in identity documents too. I do have a short link here, file.io, yada yada. I am tweeting this after the talk, so that way you don't have to remember which is a capital letter or not. And keep in mind that this is a work of the United States government. As such, it is free of copyright. Share and enjoy. Now finally, we're going to talk about the fun part, what most of you are here for, I presume. The stuff that happens that you don't see. Like I said, I did work for the law enforcement agency of this DMV for several years. This is one aspect of it. But we're going to talk about what happens after. Keep in mind that every driver services agency is either itself a branch of a law enforcement agency or has a law enforcement arm. Examples: Texas Department of Public Safety is the entity that issues a driver's license or ID card in the state of Texas. This is a police agency. ICBC Special Investigations Unit is a section of the Insurance Corporation of British Columbia, the driver and vehicle licensing agency in British Columbia. Not everyone there is a cop. Not everyone works for the cops, but these people do. They specifically look for certain things. Now, regarding IDs, I'm going to focus, obviously, on that. The first one is investigating post-issuance fraud, investigating counterfeits, identification of investigatory subjects. So we're going to start with the fraud desk. Every agency has a fraud desk. Now, as I'm sure that this has got to be shocking considering the reputation of a lot of driver services people, not all of this fraud is caught when they go to the office. Okay? Yes, for those of you who are familiar with The Simpsons, there are still a lot of Patties and Selmas there. Pro tip, the younger the person is, the less likely they are to be that way. Now, how do they investigate these claims? The first one is they get reports from law enforcement. They get also documents that have been returned to them. In the US, for example, under the Real ID standards, an individual has to present documents verifying address. If something gets kicked back that should be going to a legit address, there's an that automatically insinuates there is something wrong. Now, over the counter, that's what OTC is, back in the day when you just go into the office and walk out with a card. Once those cards were issued and out in the field, there's not much that could be done with it. This, of course, is a problem when you're trying to ensure that that document is trusted. Everyone here, at some point, has had to trust that that piece of plastic, assuming a North American context, has had to trust that that piece of plastic accurately represented who that person was, at least in a legal context. Once it's in the wild and it's got someone else's face on it, that's it. There's not much that can be done. If you're lucky as the agency, they might come back for another service and you might discover it then. That doesn't happen that often. I have experienced that. Finally, with current issuance, with central issuance, every application has facial recognition run on it. Not for the reason you might think, though. So we're going to talk about the La Policia, of course. Most frequently, what they do is they respond to information requests from other agencies, whether we're talking about, you know, Podunk, or we're talking about California. It could be any law enforcement agency could be asking them. I mean, there have been cases where I've personally had to respond to different federal agencies and to military police to provide them with information of, for example, the status of the document, or if there's something that they receive back in an automated return, which they don't understand. Because there are times where a record will go to somebody, some authorized receiver, it'll say contact agency police, because it's a weird situation. Now, again, the vast majority of the time, as I sort of implied there, these responses are sent automatically. Agency A goes onto a secure law enforcement agent, onto the secure law enforcement network, sends a request to the DMV's police agency. They get a response. Examples of these networks are things like NISPIN, New York State Police Information Network. CLETS is the California Law Enforcement. I keep forgetting the T in that one. LEADS is the Law Enforcement and Acquisition Data System. I keep forgetting some of these acronyms. It's annoying. Every state has its own network. They all hook in to, in the US, each state has its own system. Each state has a different name for it. They all hook into the FBI's master network, which is known as NLETS. Canada, a little different. Keep in mind, in Canada, you basically have one large police agency that covers the whole country, which is the RCMP. Different cities and towns have outposts of RCMP acting under contract or their own police departments. They all communicate pretty easily that way. Now, of course, let's talk about this, your threat model. Because obviously, as soon as I say facial recognition, a lot of people's heads should start to spin. Of course, like I said, it's pretty simple. Yes, they do facial recognition, okay? And this is the sort of thing that people are worried about. Let's be real here. No, this is not what it looks like in the real world, at least from the DMV point of view. Now, as soon as you take a photo, that's enrolled in their database. Everyone here should know all about enrolling facial recognition for facial recognition. You dump pictures into a database, system figures it out. Now, in some jurisdictions, you take a photo before you do anything else. In that case, even if you decide after that photo is taken to walk out, that photo will still be enrolled, even if it doesn't have necessarily identifiers associated with it. Modern ID photos for driver's licenses and ID cards are very much ICAO standards. They're the same standards that you'll find for your passport. To put it in three sentences, flat front of the face, neutral expression, ideally without glasses. Now, keep in mind that because this is the standard, there's only one image that's being used. Or, if you have a history with them, several images, but they're all going to be similar images. Facial recognition is not very good when it comes to using small sample sets. Okay, keep in mind, states are cheap, contractors are pricey, good FR is relatively expensive. So there are limits to this system that make them a little less scary. The first one is the front view of the face. Even a side view like this is not going to be very easy, if at all possible, for those systems to match. Now, these are the ideal use cases for this system, though, because there are some. The first one is comparing databases between jurisdictions, looking up mugshots, and, of course, passport and immigration credential comparison. Why? Same standard for photo. Now, this is what DMV FR really sucks at, okay? Basically everything else. So you look at these surveillance-type images, not a chance. Cell phone footage, unless you're lucky enough to get a front shot of the face, probably not. Mass footage. Think of some of the private sector samples where they've scanned sports ball arena. Won't happen. Low resolution. I mean, I'm looking at this picture here and seeing this. I'm like, I've seen pictures that are this quality and slightly better that haven't been able to get through the FR at our agency. And finally, of course, fishing expeditions. No. Fishing expedition. I know that this person looks kind of like this. That will not go for both. The simple reason that you, without an image to compare, even a good image, even a bad sketch, won't work on these systems. And finally, of course, there are laws against this. Yes, I know, police, laws, insert joke here. So this is a case study of the former, for example. In New York and New Jersey, they did have a cross-database, a cross-analysis between their systems. Literally thousands of people were discovered to have multiple active driver's licenses. Obviously for this, driver's licenses were the primary focus, but again, they also did checks on ID cards as well. Now, these are a couple of the cases of people they found that were using fake credentials. The first one being rather impressive, a sanitation worker impersonating their dead twin brother to get $500,000 of disability benefits over 20 years. In New York, another one, a fugitive that was on the lam for 17 years was discovered because they had multiple driver's licenses. None of them had their actual identity, but they had one picture, they saw that this thing came up multiple times, and they're like, 2 + 3 came together. In New Jersey, there was a man that used fraudulent IDs to get commercial driver's licenses. I mentioned an example of this before. This dude had 6 DUIs and 64 license suspensions. And keep in mind, even in cases where you've got someone patrolling you, you do not find people with 64 license suspensions, okay? Usually around number 23 or 4 or so, most people get out from behind the car. In New York, there were 12,500 cases found. But of these 12,500 cases, only about 3,000 were prosecuted. Sometimes due to statute of limitations reasons, sometimes because they found that the error was on the clerk's side. In New Jersey, they had about 2,000 cases that came up, only 1,000 were prosecuted. So again, this is probably this is to my knowledge, the only cross-state database database run that has been performed. This will probably become more frequent in the future as the cost of data and processing power decreases. Now, who actually has the ability to search? Well, the cheap answer is it depends on the jurisdiction. Where I work, there were exactly 11 people that were allowed to perform a facial recognition run. Of those 11, 5 of them never did it, and I got tasked with most of the rest. Obviously, we don't do it capriciously. We have to receive an authorized request from a law enforcement agency. Each state has different rules and guidelines on this. I happen to be in a state that was very conservative in this regard. The only reasons that you could run a check would be to identify a body, to identify a missing person, or if it's in connection with a crime, which they have to spell out. They can't say, we think this person did something. Most of these systems are functionally air-gapped. I say functionally because they're not completely isolated systems. But these are systems with extremely limited access. Now, in some states, you even require a court order. Example, Washington State requires a court order or a warrant in order to be able to perform such a run. Now, some states, on the other hand, are a lot more liberal in this regard, and it's not exactly the states that come up with that term. For example, Kansas allows law enforcement agencies to perform these searches with frequency. Generally speaking, in the research I've been able to perform, it tracks across the red-blue line. Blue states tend to be more protective of individuals' information. Red states are more willing to share. And some work directly with federal agencies. Now, what do I mean by directly? Now, again, I regularly had inquiries from federal agents. Pro tip, working in the police was probably the best thing I could have ever done to learn how to social engineer someone, because being able to talk with people and actually have something resembling authority is hard. Dealing with feds, harder. Some of them just want everything now. And you gotta tell them, sorry, can't help you. Which is about the most rewarding thing to ever do, is to tell a fed, you know. But some of them don't even bother with it. They just send it and they'll just process it right away. Again, like I said, this tends to track the red-blue state divide. And now, let's talk about this. Why am I concerned about knowing your threat model? Where are the real threats for facial recognition? Are these agencies really the threat there? Not really. Look at the private sector and look at what they're capable of doing right now. For instance, Amazon has been rolling out this recognition system, and they've been pushing it to law enforcement agencies. They enroll their mugshots, which mugshots are public records, folks. Try not to get one. Facebook is probably the world's most effective image enrollment system. Their deep face software is capable of identifying faces, even obscured and partial faces, at 97% accuracy. Google, same thing. Whenever you upload, their FaceNet software just worked a standard test batch of faces. Their accuracy was 99.6%. That is more accurate than a human. For reference, 97.5% is the standard for human facial recognition. Microsoft has its Face API, and these are just the big players. Of course, there are tons of other companies out there that will work off of this. Again, private sector facial recognition, all the little brothers, are much more advanced than what you find in the public sector. So I'm going to open the floor for questions. First off, if you're here, cue at the mic. If not, send me a tweet. I'm going to be monitoring it on this. And I thank you for your time in advance.
Yeah, question. How did you and how do other DMVs authenticate requests for information, whether it's personal information or facial recognition, from law enforcement agencies and court orders?
The vast majority of requests either are entirely through or are started via secure law enforcement networks, such as what I mentioned, NYSPIN, CLETS, LEADS, you name it. Either they will send the information directly through that network, which, again, each state network is connected to the FBI network. FBI actually sets the standards for these networks and the state police of each state determines who has access to it. It's pretty reliable as such. Now, sometimes places used to issue the address. They would call, somebody was to call me up and say, "Hi, I'm Officer Davis from the blah blah police department, and here's the address on the network." That used to be a lot more common, but the technical term for that address is known as an ORI. Those ORI lists are available. Consequently, more agencies are not trusting them.
Could you comment on the commercialization of DMV data? Meaning, are the DMV selling data to marketing agencies, and is there a way to opt out of that, or anything that we should be concerned with? Thanks.
I'll start with the second part of that question about opting out. To my knowledge, it is not possible to opt out of it. However, it's not used for marketing in most cases. Usually, an entity that wants to access DMV data like that has to have a business case for it. What do I mean? Something like an insurance company has a business case for it. Someone trying to sell you three pairs of socks on the internet does not. Now, what defines a business case will vary from state to state. Again, from what I've been able to find, it does follow that red-blue line.
Hi, I live in Vermont, and in the past 2 years, we had a little bit of a scandal where folks who worked at the DMV, did I lose the mic?
I'm aware of this situation. I'm just nodding to acknowledge
the question. Yeah, so folks who worked at the DMV would sort of casually collaborate with ICE, and they'd sort of send an email and say, "Hey, Steve at ICE, we have an undocumented immigrant coming in tomorrow for a driver's test," and ICE would come down and pick the person up. So my question is, how common is that sort of thing in other states or any kind of other similar collaboration?
There's a reason that this is considered a scandal, and that is because pretty much every jurisdiction that in the U.S. that issues a driving credential for individuals without status has either official policies or unofficial statements to the effect that they do not disclose immigration status either directly or indirectly to federal authorities. The state I worked in does have a program for issuing licenses to individuals without status. When this program, as I said, I kept my agency honest. One of the markers that I discovered was that in some of the information that would otherwise be lawful to release, it identified whether the individual had status or not. And because of what I did, I ensured that even though it wasn't an official policy, this was something that the people in charge of the agency had been promoting publicly. Literally had to get pushed up basically to all the lawyers who said, maybe it's not exactly in the law, but this is what we've said publicly, so that information does need to be redacted.
Thank you.
So, loophole idea. You don't need a driver's license to ride a bicycle, but the NYPD has been cracking down on cyclists, and if you get stopped, say, for like running a red light, you could actually get points on your driver's license. New York, however, also offers a non-driver ID, and so you could give them that, and then there's no license to get points on. So would having a New York State non-driver ID and then a simultaneous driver's license from another state raise any flags, or is that like just a terrible idea?
Yeah, that's a terrible idea. I'll tell you why in a few different ways. The first one is that when you apply for a New York State non-driver identification card, at least to my knowledge of the process, they do in fact check to ensure that you don't have a valid driving credential anywhere else in the country. So you go there, you want to get that ID card, and they see that you've got a license from Hawaii. Well, that might cause problems. The second aspect of this is that under the road rules, basically, whatever laws are in effect for that state or country for the road, the bicycle is considered a vehicle. Not necessarily a motor vehicle, but obviously a vehicle. And vehicles have to follow the rules of the road. So yes, as a biker, you're supposed to stop at stop signs and stop lights. I know most of us don't. Okay. But yes, I know that in particular, New York City is particularly aggressive about enforcing on bikers. And frankly, I think that's not a bad thing. And the reason why is because, at least with regards to like running red lights, for example, I don't like seeing bicyclists getting splattered. Personal preference. But what happens is that a driver file is created for you if you don't already have a driver's license. They just use the information that they're able to obtain from usually the citation, and they create a dummy file. And if that dummy file shows that there's nothing resolved and you go to another state, let's say you go to someplace where you need a car, like Colorado, they will do a PDPS search and they'll say, you got a problem in New York. I've never had a license in New York. Well, they say you got some issue.
Hi there, thanks for speaking. Curious on your opinion about two potential cross sections based on your experiences. One is DHS fusion centers, and the other is witness protection program, address confidentiality program members. Are there any protections for them with regard to facial recognition or surveillance databases?
I do not have direct experience, of fusion centers. I never interacted with a DHS fusion center. I did work with one or two county fusion centers that were not explicitly DHS. But in those cases, it was just usually a request for information, not a request to do, for example, facial recognition. For instance, clarification on like vehicle ownership or something. That does happen. As far as, I apologize, I forgot the second part of the question.
Witness protection.
Every state has, if you will, has considerations for certain protected classes of persons. Now, witness protection does not fall into this, and the reason why is that witness protection is a federal program. Witness protection people will usually have a contact with a, every state has what's known as a confidential license desk. It's not for confidential for you to have, it's not like protecting you saying that like, yes, I have a secret driver's license. No, it's more like when law enforcement needs credentials for various purposes, be it something like witness protection, or for undercover investigations. Individuals that have other privacy concerns or other limitations on their ability to obtain a credential, cases like this include judges. In most states, it includes first responders, domestic violence victims, parolees, homeless. There's usually a procedure for them to get a credential that doesn't show a home address. As an example, again, this is a hypothetical example. Let's say that a federal judge needs to get their driver's license renewed. When they go, they probably will have the courthouse address on their license, or a cop will have their precinct house. A homeless person or a domestic violence victim may have the address of a shelter.
That's a really good point. It brings in another aspect. You mentioned towards the end that the Amazons and the Googles have a much better capabilities. Things like Link NYC, that is not just linking faces in real time, but also can link up your phone, your address, and where you live because of your work patterns and all these kinds of things. What makes us think that the, whether local or state actors, aren't actually just kind of giving up the ghost and going to be using these sorts of corporate surveillance systems, that are multifaceted, and just going to stop kind of doing the direct, oh, I'm an NYPD surveillance camera, and how are we going to follow this?
In the U.S., it is a lot easier and it is a lot easier for law enforcement to get your information from private parties than from other parts of the government. This sounds weird, but it's true. There is the doctrine, the third party doctrine, which, with the exception only recently established of cell phone ping data, if the third party has your information, they can do whatever they want with it. They can sell it to law enforcement agencies. A lot of law enforcement agencies have contracts with, for example, LexisNexis or other data brokers. They have that as an easier approach than going to a DMV and trying to get that information. Oftentimes, it's more effective. Conversely, to my knowledge, the DMVs, with very rare exception, do not do that same sort of information checking.
Hi. So the DMV has motor vehicles in it, and I was wondering kind of the intersection of motor vehicles regards to like ALPRs, EZPass, anything involving photos of identification, or potentially your faces. What's the intersection of that regards to, I don't know.
No, I understand what you mean. Concerns about the vehicle side of the DMV.
Sure.
And license plates and tracking connected with that. Toll agencies are separate from the DMV. Most of the entities that use ALPR, to my knowledge, are separate from the DMV. I've yet to see a DMV that has an ALPR camera at its parking lot. They can request the information. Again, it has to be an authorized business purpose. If they find, but usually, like with, say, a toll tag, they have to be able to document that you've been skipping tolls. They can't just pull it up because you seem to be going slightly too fast for what physics dictate is possible. ALPR companies, they have to be able to show, in some states they just sell the data to bulk brokers, again, for a legitimate business case, which again is identifying vehicles, but again, primarily it's going to be cases where it's to resolve some kind of outstanding criminal or civil issue that is justified in law. The DMV itself doesn't have like a dog in the fight so much.
Hi, Aphrodite. My first question was just, is this your first talk?
This is my first talk.
Everybody, yay!
At Hope.
She did her first talk. Woo! Yay! Aphrodite has been hanging out at Hope since like God died a trillion years ago. I don't know why that came to it, but she started on the security team and has been totally around the edges being like, but I know this stuff about the DMV. And only just now has like brought this all to us. I just wanted to thank you because like, this is my favorite kind of Hope Talk, where it's like, here's the system and all of how it works, because I know it and I'm going to share it with you. Fantastic talk. I may have derped out. I may have missed the answer to my question, mm-hmm. but my question is just, aside from, is this your first talk? You said there's like a single image, and that's just single image in the DMV files, right, and that's that flat one. Is that, are we assuming that that's the only image also in the deeper Fed systems or stuff like that, or do we assume that they have other stuff that sort of comes into it there?
What the feds do, that's a little bit beyond my knowledge base. Except that typically, let's see, the FBI's database that they use enrolls mugshots as opposed to driver's license photos. Because a mugshot includes a side profile, it can do slightly better identification. But pretty much, if you remember whatever cards you have, for driver's license or IDs, what do they all look like? Unless you've got a really goofy face that you put in one back in the day, it's going to be a flat front shot of the face.
Or if you've got the one guy, like I went and one of the DMV guys looked at me like, I'm going to take a bad picture of you one time. Is it likely that they'll also be able to cross-check against your passport photo? How likely is that that'll be able to?
At this point in time, not likely, with the exception of typically non-citizens that are applying. If they have to refer to a visa or something, they have to check that image, and if it looks hinky, there could be problems. I do have a question that came on from Twitter. The question is, how accurate do you consider the data, particularly home address / geolocation in-state data? Keep in mind, it's all self-reported. And at least in the US context, it requires documentation to prove it. What documentation is accepted varies from state to state, but usually it's something that has at least a veneer of official status. So how accurate is it? It's as accurate as the information that's presented. Now, there are people, of course, that try to do things that are outside of the law, let's just say. Things like having things go to private post boxes, for example, is one of the most common. But again, that often, once that's discovered, we'll just get the fraud people and or the law enforcement arm involved right away. So I do want to thank you for the question online. Next, please. I've got about 4 minutes.
Okay. I wanted to thank you for a great talk. I wanted to ask, some cities, such as San Francisco and New York, have their own ID card system that kind of interacts. And I wanted to know from a like database perspective or from an information sharing perspective how that interacts with the existing DMV systems.
From what I've been able to research in states which have cities that issue these kinds of credentials, those documents are not accepted in any way, shape, or form at the DMV. Whether we're talking about an individual who has status, who is a citizen, or who has neither. So, as far as I'm aware, there is no real intersection between them. Now, what the states do with those, now what the cities do with those databases of images, I can't say. It is reasonable to assume that facial recognition is run on those images. However, that is an assumption, not something I can find hard information for.
Hello. You mentioned it's a bad idea to maintain multiple driver's licenses. Could you explain why? And there's a second part. When you say you move states, you go to a new state, you say, I want to apply for a driver's license, there is often an option that if you have an active license in another state, you can present that and skip the whole process, right? Assuming you prove residency in that new state. At that point, what happens to your old license? Do they call up the DMV and say, please invalidate this, or what happens?
So, the first part, why it's a bad idea to have multiple licenses. Well, the first reason, I mean, these are reasons in law. And the reason is that you cannot have, let's say, if you're in some states, it's more, in some jurisdictions, I should say, it's a much more enveloping prohibition. For in most states in the US, it is against the law to have a driver's license from that state and an active driver's license from another state. So if I did have, say, a Washington driver's license and a New York driver's license, if I ever, I mean, and let's say that I'm driving through Oklahoma, something happens, they look at my wallet and they see that I have both, Oklahoma could arrest me. It's a basic concept is called one driver, one record. The idea being that it's to make sure that if there are outstanding issues, there's like a single authoritative source to get that information. In some places, you can't even have a license from another country. This is typical in Canada. New York has this as a guideline as well. So you are required to surrender licenses, and typically that surrendering of the license is taken as proof of driving experience, at least from countries that they recognize. What happens with those surrendered credentials? Now, some places will just punch holes through it and kick it back to you. A lot of places nowadays, though, are retaining it. They notify the original jurisdiction electronically and or return it. If they don't return it, they typically will destroy the original credential. And I do apologize that there are more questions. We can talk outside about this. We are at time. I want to thank you all for coming, and I hope you all enjoy the circle of hope.